Before we start this episode, just want to remind you, to protect patient privacy, the details and names in the cases we will be discussing have been changed. Now, on to the episode.
Welcome to this episode of Bioethics for the People, the most popular podcast on the planet, according to Grandma Nancy. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Tyler Gibb, who, if he weren't here recording right now, would probably be golfing.
And I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Devin Stahl, who dutifully completes the same 5 New York Times puzzles every day.
Good morning, Tyler.
Good morning.
All right, so we're kicking off a special series of cases of interviews with clinical ethicists who had some success at their institution, pushing through a policy or a procedure or really crushed a case. Sometimes we just need hopeful, uplifting stories.
Yeah, the last couple of seasons have been a little dark, if we're going to be honest.
A lot of our work can be tough like that.
I'm really excited to highlight some victories, some successes.
All right, so who do we have for today?
All right, we've got Stefano from Alabama. I avoided saying your last name because I can't say it in my head yet. Munyanini.
Munyaini.
Munyaini.
All right, try
okay,
again.
Stefano. No, I'm not going to try again. I'm going to let him introduce himself.
All right, Stefano, you introduce yourself.
Okay. So I'm Stefano Munyaini. I'm originally from Florida, but I live in Alabama, and I'm one of the two primary clinical ethicists at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. My colleague Sybil is next door, and the two of us are pretty much, we work pretty closely with the ethics committee and everybody else, but we're the two folks that spend most of our time dealing with specific ethics issues and consults.
In my experience, it's actually pretty awesome that you have two full-time people. So how big is your hospital?
I don't know what the most recent numbers are, but we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 beds.
Whoa, so you're big.
Yeah, and we have a separate hospital that's, I don't know, 2 miles down the road. That's was originally a rehab, orthopedics and rehab facility that's been converted to an acute care hospital. And then we have a big clinic complex that we mostly step in to help guide decisions about tooth extractions and things like that over there, but other procedures as well. So
dental clinical ethics, that's an underexplored area for us, I think.
So my neighbor's working on a doctorate, and that is an area that sort of out of the blue she has become deeply interested in. So we're really not sure why, but she's not even sure why, but it is something we get a lot of calls because of the way this sort of surrogate hierarchy works in Alabama. If someone is truly unrepresented, we can step in and consent and make most of their decisions. And there are a lot of folks who come to us from group homes and things like that who need dental work done and don't have anybody who's able to consent. So that is a strangely growing part of our area of responsibility. So
cool. But today you have another kind of patient that you want to talk about. So did this start with a case, with a particular sort of incident at the hospital that kind of kicked off what you now see as a success story at your hospital?
Yeah, it actually, for me, it started as a paper that I wrote for school, and it concerned a case that happened at UAB before I was here. And in defense of my mentor and predecessor, Wendy Walters, who is a wonderful person who really brought me on board, she wasn't really involved in this case either. This was one of those things where everything sort of went down without ethics involvement. And years later, sort of it became clear what had transpired was not what should have transpired. So I wrote a paper about this case and then found myself reviewing policies related to it and realized that our policy didn't really accord with state law as interpreted by the judges involved.
That seems like a pretty big oversight.
Yeah. I mean, that's so often the case, right? That we run into a case. And we had one a couple of years ago where it was novel case that we'd never seen before and went to the literature. And like the society statement said, before this happens at your hospital, we recommend that you develop a policy to address this. And we're like, okay, great. That's not helpful. So there's a case, a historic case, probably one that sticks in the memory of some of the clinicians who were involved in ethics, particularly around incarcerated patients, is what you had mentioned. And so you did an analysis for school and then came back and were able to work on actually changing the policy in order to help that situation. Yep.
Great. Yeah, the first policy here that has my name on it is, related to this case. So that's for me a little bit of a point of pride. I felt like I kind of hit the ground and got something done. So
yeah, that's great.
Aspirational student work. Yeah.
Yeah. Walk us through it. Tell us about the case and kind of how you got involved with it.
Okay. So in 2014. There was a patient who was brought to us from St. Clair County Corrections Facility, which is in Springville, Alabama, which is probably an hour, not quite an hour, outside of Birmingham. And this was a guy who was doing life in prison for a 2007 murder. And somebody in the prison, he and this other individual had kind of a series of conflicts that eventually ended in Marquette Cummings, who was the individual in question, being stabbed in the eye with a shank.
Ew.
And which, you know, pretty rough situation, obviously. It sounded like in hindsight, there might have been opportunities to keep these guys separated and it didn't really happen. So he was stabbed in a prison fight, or in a fight in prison, and was brought to us and very quickly transferred to the neuro ICU. He came with a piece of paper that included instructions from the warden that no heroic measures would be taken to save his life, which is a quote. I'm not sure how they defined heroic measures, but this was essentially sent with the paperwork from the warden. And he was made DNR by one of the physicians that evening. Somewhere along the way, the patient's mother showed up, and here's where the story gets pretty murky, the reporting that I was able to uncover. She either was allowed to visit but not be involved in goals of care conversations, or she possibly wasn't even allowed to visit the bedside. The reporting on that varies. But in either case, decisions were made. The expectation and the understanding of the team was that Mr. Cummings was probably had already probably progressed to brain death. But before any of the neurological testing had begun, on the warden's instructions, they withdrew support and allowed him to expire. This, not unexpectedly, perhaps led to a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. So this paperwork, did you ever see that piece of paper? Was it in any of the reporting? What did that even look like?
That, unfortunately, I have no idea, because this happened in 2014 and I came on board in 2022. So my understanding was it was literally just that, you know, we get a packet from the prison infirmary and the prison medical staff. And my understanding, it was just basically a sheet of paper, like a face sheet or something, that someone had printed on there, take no heroic measures. And then they were in contact with the warden via phone, and it was a phone conversation where they said, go ahead and withdraw.
Okay. So they were consulting it. They didn't just go off this one piece of paper.
No.
Okay. There's immediately two big ethics questions that come up. The most glaring is, does the warden have authority to make decisions on behalf of the incarcerated patient? And the second is how should we allow or inform families about the incarcerated patient being in our hospital? And I think I know the answers to those questions that apply for most states, but I mostly get the second question because I think the first has well been settled in our policy, but I want to get to how Stefano was able to change his policy to get to it. But there is some gatekeeping that can happen, and then there's some gatekeeping that cannot happen. But I typically get the kind of, are we allowed to call the family and tell them, which is a second kind of question.
Yeah, and part of where this gets complicated in Alabama is there is really broad statutory authority given to wardens to gatekeep communication and visitation. I mean, basically universally, they're allowed to say who's allowed to visit, who's not allowed to visit, who we can call, who we can't call. Practically, there's a certain amount of, hey, we called the warden to ask if we could call the family, and they haven't gotten back to us, so what can we do? And my tendency is to say, well, until they say no, unless there's a really obvious reason why we should be concerned, my inclination is to go ahead and make that contact. But most of the time, we do try to at least talk to the warden first. One of the things that came out of not our policy change, but this case in particular, has been it's made prison wardens much less inclined to want to get into the weeds of these cases. And also has I've found that they have sometimes even in conversations I can just mention, are you familiar with Cummings versus Davenport? And they'll say, yeah, so what do you need from us?
Oh, that's good.
And they're much more willing to work because they recognize that their authority does have a terminus at some point.
So tell us about that case.
Okay.
Is that the case that came out of like that legal case?
Yeah, so and I think that I'll actually say I think part of the reason that our policy stated in our informed consent policy for convicted inmates, the warden of the prison is their surrogate decision maker. I'm not completely sure how that was part of our policy, but I think it has to do with there were a couple of other cases that sort of unrelated that sort of affirmed that to some extent a warden has some medical decision might they actually said might possibly have some sort of medical decision making authority. I think most of the time that's when they're inside the prison complex. But so because our policy stated that, everyone just kind of followed the policy and let the warden call the shots. What I've found now, having this in the background, they are quick to say, we recognize that we're not really in charge here. But with this particular case, what ultimately happened was the estate of the family sued and said that they cited a couple of different things. They sued on the basis of the prisoner not having been separated from this antagonist, because I think there were two or three separate cases where Mr. Cummings was either in an altercation or was attacked or was harassed by this other individual. So they sued on that basis. And they said it was essentially cruel and unusual punishment that there was no isolation and separation. I think that was kind of thrown out. They also sued on the basis of the warden claiming authority for, making end-of-life medical decisions for the patient without having any express right to claim that authority. And so then it all hinged on a question of, which this is a timely question, I guess, whether a person acting in that capacity can actually just use their position to claim immunity, qualified immunity, in the course of their official duties. And that was where the whole case kind of hinged.
Yeah, so he was saying, not only did I have the right to do this, I'm protected by the law for having made that decision. You can't come back and sue me. The law protects me in these scenarios. To which the judge said, what?
It's one of my favorite quotes that came out of actually, so there were two decisions in this case because it was heard by the local court and it was heard by the 11th Circuit Court. And there are great quotes in both of the decisions. Not that legal briefs are usually really great reading, but these were.
Tyler loves them.
I love
Prior, I know I some of them are really a rollicking good time.
it.
A judge by the name of William Pryor, who was the 11th Circuit Court judge, he's actually cited Ashcroft versus Al-Kid, which was a Guantanamo Bay case that came out of, in the early days of the ostensible war on terror. They were just rounding random people up and throwing them into Gitmo and then figuring out the charges later. So in this case, Pryor says, based on his reading of that, breathing room afforded by qualified immunity is generous, Although qualified immunity provides government officials with a formidable shield, their entitlement to raise that shield is not automatic.
So,
all right, so translate that for us.
Yeah. Well, so basically he said, yeah, you can do almost anything behind the guise of qualified immunity, but you yourself can't determine when qualified immunity is a relevant defense. And in this case, the broader issue was, and I think this had been mentioned by Judge Ott in the lower court ruling. He said the problem here is when there is a statute that lays out a surrogate hierarchy or anything else. And I always screw up the Latin here, but there's this legal principle of expressio unius alterius exclusio or something like that. Exclusio alterius, which means if one thing is included, all other things are excluded. I took Latin for 4 years in high school and I can
crushing it.
barely remember two phrases. I know I'm killing it. My professor, my teacher somewhere is so proud. But basically it's this idea that if you include something in a statute, then anything that is excluded, anything that's not included in that statute is necessarily excluded. So in this particular case, the state provides a surrogate hierarchy for end-of-life decision making, and it names a bunch of different people as potential surrogate decision makers, specifically at end of life, and anybody not named in that statute then is implicitly excluded from the statute.
Right. Mm-hmm. And let me guess, the warden is not on that list.
Turns out they are not. As I mentioned, they do have, there is another state law that lists very broadly all of the stuff a warden is in charge of. And it does include things like visitation and communication. But it does not provide any room whatsoever for a warden calling a hospital and saying, in the popular parlance, hey, go ahead and pull the plug. There's just nothing there for that.
Yeah. So is that a new state law, or do you think your policy? So I guess my question about your policy is, it sounds like your policy was not in accordance with the state law, right? That your policy was allowing the warden to make decisions, even though state law didn't allow the warden to make decisions. Is that right?
Yes, but I think it's more that the law had never been really explored in this particular context. And so there was an interpretive process. And I mentioned there are a couple of other, the most notable one, another case was about a guy who was the acting something or other supervisor at Tutwiler, which is a women's maximum security prison. And he was in this acting role for like 18 months, and he wanted to get the job permanently, and they didn't offer it to him, and they cited the fact that he was a male, and they felt like he couldn't do the duties of this job as a male. And one of the things that it hinted at was a warden had some responsibility for the medical needs of inmates, and if it's a male warden, he couldn't understand the needs of a female inmate. And that was one of the reasons why he was not chosen for law. And so there's this sort of legal nod to the idea that perhaps wardens do have some involvement, appropriate involvement in medical decisions. And I think that was probably what was used to sort of justify this idea. But no one had ever really tested it related to an end of life situation. And that's what happened in this case.
Stefano, that is such a leap, though. I mean, for this like kind of obscure case about a male-female discordance, to presume then that the warden can make any and all end-of-life decisions seems to me like a hospital lawyer was either like totally in the dark about this policy being written, or made quite the like inference from that case, which seems like, come on, that can't be like a popular case in Alabama that everybody knows about. So like dredged it up and was like, well, I guess I'm going to make a leap here and say wardens get to make decisions for patients while they're in our hospital, which again is like a different context, because making medical decisions in the infirmary and making medical decisions in the hospital is also not the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That case is Edwards versus Alabama, Department of Corrections from 2000, by the way. And I'm just speculating. I really don't know if that's how it was interpreted, but my guess is that's one of the only cases that was ever involving this idea of wardens and decision making. And I suspect that is the leap that was made, but I agree. I don't think that it was necessarily an appropriate one. But I think you could probably interpret that as to say, well, as long as the decisions in question are not technically end of life, there's at least a defensible aspect to that policy, even if it's not maybe the best idea.
Seems like a bad idea. Okay.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
Let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say they were trying. There wasn't a lot of direction, so they did the best that they could. But then this case happens.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that the warden is not supposed to make end-of-life decisions. And then you're this great student who recognizes this. You get hired at the hospital. You look over the policy and go, uh-oh, there's a big problem here. So how did you move from, like, I see a problem, newly hired clinical ethicist who wrote a student paper once, to actually changing your hospital policy?
Yeah, and this is where my zeal outstripped my wisdom, or my my phronesis, as Pellegrino would say, I guess.
You outkicked your coverage, is how we
say it. Yeah, I just basically started pounding my desk and screaming in ethics meetings, ethics committee meetings. I mean, I probably wasn't quite as dramatic as I think I was, but I just said, we run into these cases constantly, and I don't think this is a workable system. We're clearly contrary to the law. So then I also just started, I probably shouldn't say this for something that's going to be out in the world, I just started coming up with my own practice, trying to figure out how I could navigate these situations. And it so happened that the summer when we were working on the policy revision, we had a couple of situations where there were pretty significant aspects to the situation that made it where, like, the warden's ability to limit visitation was probably a good idea because of some safety concerns, because of the violent nature of some of the crimes for which these people were incarcerated, and concern that there may be people out there with a real desire to get back at them. And that actually gave me a really good opportunity to have some long conversations with the warden at one of the prisons and kind of work out a process that, although clunky, was at least workable, which is essentially we contact the warden anytime we get a patient in this kind of situation, you know, possible end of life, imprisoned. We have them automatically get ethics involved. We make contact with the warden and we basically say, you know, we've got to talk to family to get the right person acting as surrogate. How do you propose we do that? Do you want to be the first contact, or do you want us to be the first contact? And most of the time, we've gotten very little pushback. And they've said, yeah, let us make contact with them first, and then we'll get back in touch with you. And so once they've made first contact and we've had some conversations with them about things like visitation, generally speaking, they will allow some limited visitation, and most restrictions on communication are off the table. So somewhere in that process, I was able to come back to the ethics committee and say, listen, I've just sort of come up with a sort of workable way of doing this, and I really think we should enshrine that into policy. And then they called my bluff and said, great, write the policy and send it to us.
Of course they did. Of course they did. Who else wants to write that policy? Right. Yeah. That's great. So it started with the relationship. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me, is you started talking with the warden. Because it's easy to kind of pigeonhole somebody as being like a bad actor or like unreasonable if you've never actually tried to have the conversation. So you establish this relationship. You sort of set the terms. This is genius. By saying, like, by giving over some authority, saying, you know the contacts, would you like to be the first to reach out or not? So that, and you didn't frame it as a question, you said, so that we can find the appropriate decision maker. And so by setting the terms that way, there was no ambiguity about who was supposed to be making these decisions.
Right.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and you also set it up so, like, the thing that we cared about most, the ethics consultation service, or you cared about most, is making sure that that question was answered, right? And it didn't become like a power struggle about, like, who's in charge of this patient, and you know, are you transferring authority, and all these other things. I find that that's often the most important thing that ethics consultants can do is help distill the question into, okay, in this situation, regardless of all the other weird context that is going on that we can or can't control, we want to make sure the right person is making the right decision for this person as they die, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are going to agree with that as the problem that we're trying to solve. And here's an example of a way in which I've figured out how to do it. And I think that's really great. Tell me about cold calling the warden. How'd you get in contact with them? Because I've cold called a lot of people. I cold called presidents of hospitals. I've cold called probate court judges, legislators. I've never cold called a warden.
You know, once upon a time, I worked in sales and I hated cold calling and I wasn't very good at it. But I will say prison wardens are easier to get a hold of than just about anybody else. It's really remarkable, at least in Alabama. And I think some of that is there is a certain weight when I get a hold of the person that answers the phone for them and say, hey, I'm one of the ethics consultants at UAB Hospital. We've got a patient here. Need to talk to the warden. There's not usually a lot of gatekeeping. They're pretty quick to put me through because they recognize that, you know, there's some pretty critical things happening. The other thing I mentioned earlier, a lot of times I'll invoke this case and most of the, there's a fascinating website called Prison Legal News that again, surprisingly interesting, but most of the wardens that I've encountered have become aware of this case such that they're very quick to say, yeah, we understand that this is not something we can make decisions about, but we need to, you know, figure out what we're going to do. So I've actually found that they've been much more accommodating and much less resistant than I probably would have expected. I've had a different experience with jails than with prisons, but that is probably I don't know if that's a subject for now or for another day. What do y'all think?
Well, maybe try it out and see. We'll see if it makes the cut.
Okay.
No, tell us.
The biggest issue with jails is because it's much more of a transient situation, most of their medical staff are outsourced from out of state. So my impression in encounters with them has been that they care very little about what the laws in Alabama actually are. And their biggest concern is, I mean, they don't feel responsible for the patient in the same way that prison medical staff and other staff, all other things being equal, I think they do have a sense of responsibility for the people under their charge. And I don't see that same level of kind of a sense of responsibility from the jail. So we've gotten a lot more pushback from jails saying, no, we're making all these decisions. We're telling you what to do. And also jails are really quick at end of life to just release somebody. And I mean, they sort of couch it in compassion terms, but I think it's more about not getting saddled with a lot of medical bills. But I don't know if that is maybe too judgmental on my part or not.
Oh, that's interesting. So I heard a guard once say, who was standing like positioned outside of a hospital room, say something to the effect of, you can't let him die. He has to serve out his term. As if like justice demanded to keep this patient alive or to prolong his death because he hadn't quite fulfilled his sentence, which was just like a mind-boggling thing to say, but wouldn't happen with a jailer who is less concerned with that because they presumably aren't in for long sentences.
Yeah, I mean, that's generally speaking, you're on your way somewhere else if you're in jail. That idea, though, of, you know, we can't let this guy die because he has more, you know, suffering to do before his sentence is up. That bothers me on a theological level more than anything else, I think.
Yeah, I love that, a theological level. Absolutely. Like, there's so much wrong with a statement like that.
Yeah.
Maybe for another episode.
Yeah.
So I do have a question, Stefano, something I was thinking about when we talk about what a warden can and cannot do. So can, in Alabama, and I think in a lot of states, filter communication. And that's actually, this has been explained to me, like you were saying, as a safety issue, that if some people in this person's life were to know they were in the hospital, that you could get access to them, that might place them at a safety risk or their family at a safety risk. And that actually does make sense to me. And so you have to have a relationship with a warden who's not trying to like punish the in the incarcerated person, right? There could be bad actors in this, but we'll presume that that's not what's going on. But my posture toward that has always been that there has to be such an explanation in order for us not to reach out.
Right.
That there really has to be a reason. They can't just say, oh, I'm not going to call the family for arbitrary reasons. They have to say, they have to very affirmatively say, this is a safety risk. They have to be able to explain that. Mm-hmm. Right. And so sometimes we do press a little bit if they mm-hmm. say, no, we can't contact the family, or, oh, no, I'm not going to do it. Say, well, we're happy to do it unless you think there's a reason, you know, unless you can give us a compelling reason not to. Mm. What do you think of that?
Is that, just to jump in, do you think that's any different than the criteria we use in order to limit anybody's visitation to any of the patients, though? Is there something unique about being incarcerated that changes that? Yeah. Stefano, what do you think?
Well, so, yeah, I think that the same basic premise is there, that there are situations where it isn't necessarily safe to have someone coming into the hospital. I think the only difference or distinction is, in one case, you do have a legal statement that a warden has this particular authority. Whereas if it's, you know, the hospital having to make that decision, it's our own sort of policy that suggests that we have that authority. An additional wrinkle to this, they just passed a law in Alabama fairly recently that allows someone to designate an essential caregiver who basically, without really strong reasons, is not allowed to be asked to leave the room at any time. And this was some response to baggage from COVID, when there were times when people really probably should have been allowed to have somebody in the room with them, especially if that person was willing to bear the risk of being in that room, and they were excluded. So they wrote this law that basically says, you know, you can designate an essential caregiver, you can designate up to four, and they can alternate, and one of them has a right to be with you at all times, with the exception of a sterile procedure or, you know, something where you can't have somebody in the room, or if there are behavioral dangers that arise. So there's like that additional layer, kind of legal pressure to allow access. But I think that really the distinction is just that a warden is named. But I tend to view that as a sort of a negative, right? In that until they tell us no, the assumption is, like any other patient, we can reach out to family. For good or for ill, that's the way that I tend to interpret that authority.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So one other question, as we kind of wrap up this case, what is the rate or your experience with incarcerated patients having completed advanced directive paperwork?
Very, very limited. I don't have a specific number on that. Anecdotally, I've been here 2 years and we average about 500 to 600 consults a year. A lot of those are very quick, hey, who's the surrogate phone calls. They're not super involved. But so I don't know. I've probably been involved in close to 1,000 situations, and I can only think of one case where an inmate had an advanced directive when he arrived. Now, there have been some who have filled them out here, but I don't think it's very high.
Yeah, I guess, as I think about that question, like, I don't think I've ever read anything about those rates or statistics or outreach into that population for that point, but maybe I'm just ignorant on the literature.
It'd be a great, like, in-processing thing to do, though, right? If anything were to happen, what would you want?
Mm-hmm. We do have an intervention here where part of the nursing intake is asking some of those questions, and it gives an opportunity to flag a chaplain to come and fill out an advanced directive with a patient, which is, I think, a really good thing. Unfortunately, what we wind up with in a lot of cases is someone, even if they initially express interest, a lot of times when someone comes to actually fill the AD out, they're like, nope, no interest in doing that, not going to talk about it. Or they have lost capacity, and in either case, it becomes a moot point.
Well, Stefano, would you say that this policy that you wrote, I mean, you were kind of already doing it, but you wrote it into policy. It sounds like then it's been a huge success, right? So are other people now following your strategy? Do you think it's been mostly successful? You said this, the jailers maybe not quite so much, but what do you think the success rate now is of this policy that you wrote?
Well, I think the biggest challenge that we're running into now is education and dissemination of the policy. It's worked really well when we have done it. We've had multiple situations where we were allowed to get someone's daughter to see them at end of life and participate in their at least the decision making around, what that death looked like. I can think of multiple cases where we were able to accomplish that. And I feel really good about that. I think it's been very successful. The challenge is an institution our size, it's been very difficult to get that information out to the people. So we do a monthly didactic for the ICU resident group. We do something with the ICU fellows each year as they come on board. We teach a didactic for the nursing residency, which is, all new hire nurses that are new grad nurses that come on board. A couple other little situations. And we make sure to talk about this in every single group of people that we speak to. And yet still, in a lot of cases, we'll eventually get looped in and they're like, well, the warden's just been consenting to everything up until now, but somebody said maybe they're not supposed to, so we thought we would call you. And we
Right.
love those because we're like, sweet, it's an opportunity to educate everybody who happens to be standing in this corner. But I think that's the thing. It's been really successful, but we've not come up with a comprehensive way to let everybody in the institution know, hey, the policy has changed. And we thought about sending mass emails and things like that, but I don't read any of those, so I find it so. I mean, I read them all and digest them deeply.
But you understand the impulse not to.
Right, exactly.
Good. Well, good luck on continuing to
Well,
educate.
thank you.
That's such a big hurdle. You can have the perfect policy, but if no one knows it exists, it's not the perfect policy quite yet.
Right.
Yep.
That's a good point.
Good. Well, thanks, Stefano. We appreciate you being here, and thanks for telling us about your success story.
Yeah,
Thanks
thank
for
you.
having me. This is really fun.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Bioethics for the People. We can't do it alone, so a huge shout out to Christopher Wright for creating our theme music and to Darian Golden Stahl for designing our logo and all of the artwork. If you're into what we're doing, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen. And if you're really into what we're doing, head over to bioethicsforthepeople.com to snag some merch.
It's statutorily, can't talk. You might edit that out.
Yep.
It is
We definitely
statutorily granted to the warden.